Thank you, Christopher. So I've been talking to my two young adult children a lot in the last 2 or 3 weeks about their lives and changes they're contemplating, decisions they're trying to make about jobs and where they live, about relationships, all those kind of questions that I think we associate particularly with youth and young adults. I think about who's here today. Greta, in her gap year, having adventures, and despite COVID, finding ways to do exciting and interesting things in different cultures, and Liz doing her internship at Sojourners Community with Sojourners Magazine after finishing college. Ella Dean is finishing high school the next week or two, I believe is right. She told me she's leaving town on the 28th. She and I are trying to arrange breakfast this next week, but I think she's heading to California to do her own gap thing. And, you know, we've been learning that James Schultz wants to be Nico these days. So identity, who am I? How do I see myself? How do I want the world to see me? What am I going to do with my life? Are certainly youth and young adult questions. But I also think they're questions we all think about time and again as we live our lives. What's the purpose of my life? What should I be doing with my time and energy? And what's God? What is my faith and what I believe have to do with those choices? Because whenever changes happen or we feel restless and sense that changes need to happen, we have to make choices. And we're thrust again into wrestling with those questions. I'm thinking about other changes that people are going through. A teenage child leaving home. Becoming a grandparent, retiring from a job you've done for years, losing your job or feeling the need to get out of a job, having to drop a long-term pastime, dealing with health changes, becoming a caregiver on a much of an aging parent. Changes even that happen just in our cycle of of your role here at First Baptist, just as we elect new people and other people rotate off out of roles. Maybe change is happening in another organization where you've been very involved. All these shifts, all these changes involve us thinking again, well, who am I? What do I want to be doing? Where's my energy? Where's life for me right now? And where is God's spirit possibly leading me? And of course, it's January, a new year, which also sort of brings that up, I think, for us. Although, admittedly, many of us are actually more oriented to feeling a new year in September than we are in January because we're so used to the school cycle. But January has its own set of sort of, well, okay, it's a new year. And goodness knows, after the last two years, we are very aware there's a lot of what's coming we can't predict. There's a lot of uncertainty that we don't know what will be coming in this new year. And yet we wonder, who am I? Who are we as a church? And as we go forward into this new year, where am I supposed to be focusing? Where are we supposed to be focusing? What is our calling from God for this season of our lives? So it was with that mindset this week that I came to this story about John and Jesus and Jesus' baptism. John the Baptist, it strikes me, was crystal clear about who he was, but also about who he was not. He didn't let other people's expectations and hopes define who he was meant to be. They were wondering and expecting maybe he's the Messiah, but he was very clear, no, I am not. That's not who I am at all. There was a certainty in him, and there was also a humility. He knew who he was not, and that's just as important sometimes. In fact, Parker Palmer tells a story that a woman helped him realize that sometimes when things close, when we realize our limits, that can be just as important to give us a sense of direction as when things open for us. And then we had this version here of Luke of Jesus's baptism. In some ways, it's pretty understated. There's no conversation between John and Jesus recorded. There's no place like in the Gospel of John, where John sort of says, here is the Lamb of God. You know, none of that happens. It's as if Jesus just joined the crowd. All these people were going down the Jordan and getting baptized by John, and Jesus went to see, and then he got baptized too. But then something more happened for him. The Spirit of God came on him in the form of a dove, and the voice of God spoke to him, "This is my Son, my beloved, with whom I am well pleased." It was a definition, maybe a confirmation in the new whole, probably a confirmation in a whole new way of who he was, of what his identity was. But he didn't tell him what he was supposed to do with that identity. In fact, we know, we keep reading, that he went from his baptism into 40 days in the wilderness to try to figure out what he was supposed to do based on that identity. Whenever I read these words that God spoke to Jesus, "You're my Son, my beloved, and you I'm well pleased," I'm reminded of the writer, the Catholic writer Henry Nouwen, a number of years ago, who invited us all to read this as being spoken to us as well in our baptism. And when we embrace God's love for us through baptism, God is saying to each and every one of us, "You are my child, you are my beloved, and you I am well pleased." In our baptisms, we say yes to that. We open ourselves to that. We claim our identity as beloved children of God. And then we spend the rest of our lives figuring out what that means and what we're supposed to do out of that, living out of that identity. So on this Sunday, when we also remember the life, the legacy, the witness of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I find it interesting to reflect on his vocational journey, his figuring out who he was and what he was supposed to do with his life. I like to always remind people that he was a Baptist. He grew up in Atlanta, the son and the grandson of Baptist ministers. His father and grandfather were active, prominent pastors there in the Atlanta community, probably quite conservative. We might consider them almost fundamentalists theologically in some ways, but they were very engaged with the social challenges of the Black community in Atlanta there in the Jim Crow South. That's where Martin grew up. But then he was smart. He was academically gifted. He was a scholar. So he did his undergraduate degree there at Morehouse College in Atlanta, but then he left the South and went north. He did his divinity degree at Crozier Seminary, a doctorate at Boston University. His plan for his life was that he was going to be an academic. He was going to be a professor. But several of his academic professor mentors had taken some period of time to pastor for a little bit. So he thought, well, okay, that might be good. Just get some practical experience in the church, theological experience, before I live out my call to be a professor. The opportunity that opened for him was back in the South, Montgomery, Alabama, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. He and his wife, Coretta, really hesitated about that. They had known some more freedom in the North. Did they really want to go back South? But they decided this was the next step, so they moved to Montgomery. Again, in his academic work, King had wrestled to form a theology that wasn't just personal but also social. He had read Rauschenbusch and Niebuhr and Mahatma Gandhi, trying to put together a social understanding that could apply to the Jim Crow, the racism that he knew existed in America. And in Gandhi's message of love and nonviolence, he found a solution, something that made sense to him. When you reread his biography, you see that he did all this intellectual, theological work, but he wasn't doing anything practical with it. And then he was all of a sudden in Montgomery, Alabama, trying to be a pastor. I said to my son, actually, in the last couple of days. When you go to seminary, they don't teach you the practical stuff, like how to deal with, they teach you all this head stuff. They don't teach like, how do you deal with the trouble, the difficult, lots of things they don't teach you. But he went out and tried to figure out how to be a pastor. And then, and he even says he had to kind of get out of his academic style of speaking that he'd gotten into and remember how to preach like a black pastor in Alabama and not like a professor in Massachusetts. And he was also trying to figure out how to help his people respond to what was going on in their community. All around him in Montgomery was status quo, Jim Crow laws solidly in place, white Montgomery firmly in charge. But in the black community, there was growing discontent. There were some activist leaders and preachers, but other people were really, really, really cautious. And you know, for all we today think of Dr. King as the leader of the civil rights movement, this story is really telling because he didn't go there planning to be that. He didn't think he was going to be that. And we know he wasn't the tipping point. It was Rosa Parks, the activist, the secretary of the local chapter of the NAACP, who finally one day in 1955 decided she'd had enough. And she got on that bus and she sat in the front row of the black section. And when too many white folks got on and they told her to move back, she just said, no, no more. She was arrested and a meeting was called in the black community to figure out how they were going to respond because people felt something had to be done. And there was real fear that violence was going to break out, that some of the younger men were going to do something that was going to cause real trouble to break out. So they called for the boycott of the buses that most black folks rode to work every day to start on Monday, December 5th. The leaders hoped that maybe 60% of the black riders would join in the boycott. But when Monday morning came, the buses were empty. The entire black community had joined in the effort. And the next day they called for a mass meeting. The leaders gathered beforehand to figure out a plan, to give themselves a name. And somebody nominated Martin Luther King Jr. to be their president. He was totally shocked. He was one of the newest and one of the youngest pastors in town. I've read that there are people today that claim that they nominated him because they knew he'd be the best. But other people speculate that maybe they nominated him because he was new. And if it didn't work, he could be the scapegoat. And he wasn't already caught up in the politics of who was important and who was influential in the community. Sorry, I lost my notes. Here we are. Dr. King didn't know whether he should say yes. He was very unsure. He had very little time. But finally he said, okay, if I can serve, I'll try. He went home to tell Coretta what he'd just committed to. And then he had about 20 minutes to organize and figure out what he was going to say that night at the mass meeting. And he writes that he spent about 5 minutes of that 20 in a panic attack. He was so scared, so anxious, so uncertain. What should he do? What should he say? And finally, he just prayed to God, give me strength, give me clarity. If this is supposed to happen, help me. When he arrived at the church, it was packed with thousands. It overflowed into the yard. They were singing and praying. And then he stood up to speak finally. And it was as if his whole life came together at that moment. He spoke of the ideals of democracy. He spoke of the people's suffering and of racial injustice. And he said, "We're here this evening to say to those who have mistreated us so long, that we are tired of being segregated and humiliated, tired of being kicked about by the brutal feet of oppression. We have no alternative but protest." But then he went on, "In our protests, There will be no cross burnings. There will be no threats, no intimidation. There will be no violence. We will be guided by the highest principles of law and order. Our actions must be guided by the deep principles of our faith. Love must be our regulating ideal. Jesus, he reminded them, told us to love our enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. If we fail to do this in our protests will end up as meaningless drama. But if we protest courageously and yet with dignity and Christian love, when the history books are written in the future, somebody will have to say, there lived a race of people, of Black people, who had the moral courage to stand up for their rights, and thereby they injected a new meaning into the veins of history and civilization. It was everything he'd ever studied, and it contained the kernels, really, of everything he ever spoke and wrote the rest of his life. That night in Montgomery, Alabama, Martin Luther King Jr. came into his ministry, the purpose of his life. But he didn't know it was coming. He came into his ministry and all those pieces came together because of people who pushed him, like Rosa Parks, because of preparation he made, not knowing really what he was preparing for, because of the longings of his own heart and his deep Christian faith. The Spirit of God brought all that together and put fire in his bones, fire in his words to motivate people that day and in the months and years ahead. We're not called to be Martin Luther King Jr. We're not called to be Jesus. We are called to be ourselves. You know that saying that when we die and it would go to, the image at Peter's gate. Nobody's going to ask us when we die and go to heaven, why were you not Martin? Why were you not Abraham? Jesus? Why were you not Elijah? But we will be asked, were you Meg? Were you Marge? Did you live into who you were meant to be as Marion and Hans and Tracy, Marlene and Judy, all of us? Have we been our full selves? How do we live more fully into the people God made us to be? And in this season of our lives, is a time to reflect and say, who am I? Who are we as a church? Who are we as a community of faith? What are our particular gifts, our strengths? And that definition of vocation, what gives us deep joy? What is our deep gladness? And how does that connect to the needs of the world in a way that can make a difference in our lives and in the lives of the people we impact? That's what we're always being called to. Our deep gladness, our gifts, not to be anyone else but ourselves, but always to live more fully into who we are no matter what's going on, wherever we are in our lives. I never thought about the phone ringing, sitting in the church office on a Sunday morning. So, friends, you are such gifted and loving people. We are gifted and loving community of faith. Let us go courageously into this new year, moving forward with all the challenges. And I know for some of you, they're deeply personal and difficult. For all of us, there's so much about this year that we just don't know what it means or how to deal with it. But God has gifted us. God's Spirit is in us. The fire of God's love is here to lead us forward, helping us to live as the beloved children of God that we are. Let us go forth with faith and courage and great hope to see what happens. Amen.